Hey guys, I'm Heidi Preeb. Welcome back to my channel, or welcome if you're new here. Recently on this channel, we've been talking a decent amount about emotional neglect. And today in particular, I want to talk about emotional neglect and decision making. Specifically, why decision making can often feel so difficult and frankly quite agonizing for those of us who did grow up with that early emotional neglect patterning. And without that stronger natural awareness of the relationship between our inner world and the outer world. So, in a nutshell, when we have early emotional neglect, a lot of us learn to treat both our circumstances and our emotions as kind of fixed realities. So, for example, if we are unhappy with some element of a relationship, instead of asking ourselves questions like, how do I communicate more of what I want? Or how could I interact with this person in a way that might feel more fulfilling for me? We might think about our options as either take the relationship exactly as it is without complaining and find a way to make peace with what we don't like internally, or leave and put ourselves in a different relationship. So manage our feelings internally or remove ourselves from the external situation might feel like our only options. Or if we're struggling at work, instead of going, what might make me feel more alive in this role? Or which conversations might I need to be having with my boss or my team members to make things easier on me? We might automatically go to, I can adapt to the role that I originally took on, or I can leave and find a different job. But again, that option to dynamically interact with our circumstances to make them suit us better often does not occur to us. So, while people who are a little bit more aware of that relationship that exists between their inner world and their environments might see life as this kind of ongoing conversation or negotiation between themselves and their circumstances, or themselves and other people, for those of us with early emotional neglect, it can start to feel like if we want to be happy, we have to find the perfect circumstance. So, the perfect career, the perfect place to live, the perfect partner or relationship, whatever it is. Because our options, insofar as we see them, are find the perfect thing or adapt to something imperfect, which very naturally can make decision-making feel agonizing. Right? But what I would like to suggest in this video is that this is not the only way that we can approach decision-making. And in fact, our long-term satisfaction with the decision tends to depend a lot less on finding the perfect option beforehand, and a lot more on our ability to stay attuned to ourselves and exercise emotional agency after we make a decision, so that the decision can start to grow and mold alongside us. So, in this video, we're going to talk about some of the decision-making strategies or rules that we may have adopted if we grew up with early emotional neglect, and then how we can start replacing those rules or strategies with things that make decision-making feel a lot more manageable, a lot less stressful, and overall just lower stakes. Because we're no longer going to be front-loading all of the pressure onto the decision itself. We're going to start talking about how to work with ourselves the entire way through. So, the first decision-making strategy that you might have unconsciously adopted if you had early emotional neglect that can cause a lot of trouble later on in life is making decisions that are trying to replicate the external conditions we had at a point in the past when we felt good, rather than getting clear on what it was about the way that our inner worlds were interacting with those circumstances at that point in time that made it feel so good in the first place. So, if that sounds super abstract, just bear with me for a minute here. Let's say, for example, that you go away to university. And for the first time in your life, you feel genuinely happy, which may have been for a variety of reasons, right? It may have been the novelty of living away from home for the first time, or it might have been the intellectual stimulation of what you were learning, or it might have just been being in a new social environment that felt really good, whatever it was. But because you may never have learned to tune into yourself and really notice which parts of a given experience are feeling more or less fulfilling, you might have just internalized in a kind of broad stroke, higher education feels good. And then at a later point in your life, you might decide to return to school and get another degree, expecting it to bring that same satisfaction. And if it doesn't, you might figure there's just something wrong with you. Because for some reason, you're not enjoying this thing that is so clearly and objectively good. not realizing that the things that once made you so happy about going to school might now be partially or even totally irrelevant. Like the thrill of living on your own for the first time, or the friendships that you had at that point in time feeling really inspiring. So when we have that early emotional neglect, we can sometimes be prone to doing this, to over-indexing on certain objective things outside of the self that we've made positive associations with when we're making decisions, rather than being aware of the context that that original circumstance arose inside of and what was going on that felt so unique about the interaction between our inner world and our outer world at that time. So maybe at the time we left for school, we were feeling really constrained and we were wanting more independence or more intellectual exploration, whatever it was. And so it felt so good to express those parts of ourselves and to find an environment that was conducive for us continuing to explore that part of our inner worlds. Whereas maybe that second time around, we're coming into school feeling totally burnt out. And actually, it would be a lot more fitting for where we're at to take a long vacation. So again, the problem is that we're not really looking at that relationship between our inner worlds and the environment. We're just thinking of certain things or certain environments or certain people as objectively good or bad. And so to switch this, of course, we need to start thinking in the opposite way. So we want to develop the strategy of tuning into ourselves and where we are at in the present when we're making a given decision. And then look for the environments or contexts that are going to allow us to express the parts of ourselves that most want or need to be expressed currently. So it's not about finding the best possible partner or the best possible school or the best possible job in an objective sense, right? It's about finding the external context that's going to dynamically engage with our inner world in the most satisfying or the most enlivening way. So maybe what we're actually craving isn't another degree per se, it's just intellectual stimulation. And maybe there are 10 different ways to cultivate that besides going back to school. Or maybe what we think we want is to move to another city, but what we actually want is more spontaneity, more community, more beauty in our day-to-day lives. And so once we start understanding our underlying desires that is driving a given decision, suddenly we have a lot more options for meeting that underlying desire. So the shift, once again, is from trying to recreate the circumstances that once made us happy to trying to figure out what type of relationship needs to exist between ourselves and our circumstances now that is going to be fulfilling for us in the present, which is a totally different ballgame that tends to offer us a lot more flexibility and a lot more freedom, right? Even after a given choice has been made, because we can keep working with what's going on for us now. The second strategy that we might have internalized for decision-making if we have early emotional neglect is adapting to what our environments need rather than tuning into personal desire. Now, before we get into that strategy, I want to take a quick minute to thank the sponsor of today's video, Factor. When it comes to decision fatigue, one of the places where I most commonly experience it personally is when it comes to food. So this summer in particular, I've been traveling a ton, my schedule has been all over the place, and it's made figuring out what to cook and what to eat feel exhausting, which is why I've been so happy to be using Factor. Factor delivers chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals straight to your door, so I always know that there's real food waiting for me at the end of the day, even if I've spent the whole day filming or I've been bouncing between different cities. The meals are built with balanced macros and at least two vegetables, so I also don't have to think too hard about whether or not I'm hitting my nutrition goals. And there is literally no planning, no prep, and no cleanup with Factor. The meals are ready in just a couple of minutes, which I've been finding especially nice lately. And they also have over 70 add-ons, so if you want to grab something quick alongside your meal, like a protein drink or a snack, there are plenty of options that fit into a busy week. 97% of people say Factor helps them live a healthier life, and 92% say it makes their life less stressful, and I can definitely see why that is. I use Factor, and I think it's a great option for anyone whose schedule tends to get hectic, but who still wants eating well to feel simple. Head to factor75.com or click the link below and use the code PREVFB50 to get 50% off your first Factor box plus free breakfast for 1 year. That's code PREVFB50 at factor75.com to get 50% off plus free breakfast for a year. This offer is only valid for new Factor customers with the code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription purchase. Now, back to that second strategy of tuning into what our environment seems to need rather than what we want for ourselves when making a decision. And the first thing I want to make clear here is that there is nothing wrong with wanting to contribute things that are valuable to our environments or to the people around us, right? Having a sense of significance and belonging are really core parts of the human experience that I would even argue most of us are happiest when we're striving towards. The problem is that sometimes we get into the habit of adapting to what our environment needs at the expense of what feels healthy or good to ourselves. So when we start kind of routinely replacing questions like, what is interesting to me, or what feels exciting, or what do I want to work on right now, with the question, what do the people around me seem to most need or want for me, is where we start getting into trouble. But this may have been the question that was once our only route to significance, right? So if we did not grow up in environments where people took an interest in our inner world and in what we were thinking or feeling or wanting, usually the best way to make connections was to figure out what other people were thinking or feeling or wanting and needing, and then to find a way to make ourselves useful to them. And so over time, this can end up shaping itself into another false dichotomy, where we figure that if we want to tune into and fulfill our own desires, we need to be alone. But if we want connection or significance or a place in a community or the world, we have to forget about what we want and focus on what is going to make us most useful to others. And of course, the opposite of this strategy is to figure out where those things more naturally intersect. So when it comes to work, instead of asking which of my skills are the most valuable to other people, we want to get in the habit of first asking, what kind of activities do I naturally gravitate towards when nobody needs anything of me? Or what problems do I genuinely enjoy thinking about? Or what would I probably spend a whole bunch of time learning or doing, even if nobody was paying me? And then asking, where in society might those skills be useful? Okay, rather than approaching it the other way around. Or instead of choosing partners through the lens of who has a set of needs that I know how to fulfill, because maybe their needs are very similar to the needs of the people in my early environment, we tune into ourselves first and ask things like, who am I when nobody else is around? What do I genuinely enjoy doing or thinking about when I'm left to my own devices? What kind of a pace do I like my life to naturally happen at? What conversations interest me? What kind of a life do I naturally want to build for myself? And then asking ourselves, who might genuinely enjoy sharing that kind of life with me? So we're kind of switching the perspective that we're looking at this from. Instead of going, how do I figure out connection by figuring out how I'm valuable to others? We start with, what kind of a person am I? And then ask, who would enjoy that type of person? So we're no longer seeing our needs and desires and others' needs and desires as in competition. We're starting to seek out genuine compatibility. Third decision-making strategy that we may have adopted if we grew up with early emotional neglect is keeping our options open for as long as humanly possible. And this strategy tends to serve two core purposes. Okay, so one is that it allows us to maintain our agency for as long as possible. Because again, if we have that idea that we are living in alignment with, that once we choose a given situation or a given relationship or a given context, we then have to completely and totally adapt to it, not choosing or keeping our options open keeps us in a place where we feel like we still have a sense of control and choice for much, much longer, which of course feels preferable to being in a situation where we feel low agency. But the thought distortion here, of course, is the idea that agency disappears as soon as we make a decision, which is not in reality the case. The second reason we might be prone to keeping our options open is because delaying a decision often also keeps us from having to grieve. Okay, because every decision that we make in life necessarily comes with some form of loss, even if that's just the loss of the potential that the other path represented for us. But if we don't have much experience of moving through grief or loss and then getting to the other side intact, we might end up orienting a lot of our lives around avoiding ever having to face it. And so we might keep our options open, even in situations where we kind of know in our guts what we would rather do, solely because we haven't learned the skill of closing doors and then emotionally regulating around them staying closed. And of course, different skills are going to be needed to counteract each of the underlying fears that are driving this strategy. So to counteract that first fear of losing our agency after we make a decision, what we have to get in the habit of doing is making decisions with the expectation that we will continue participating in them after we have made them. So instead of asking, which option can I tolerate exactly as it is forever? We start looking at things like which environments or which type of partner or whatever it is most likely to support me in speaking up for myself if I feel unhappy with something down the road? Or which context will it feel easiest for me to experiment inside of and then make the adjustments that I need to make my decision more comfortable for myself over time? So we start to make choices with the explicit goal of maintaining our agency and being supported in maintaining our agency as time goes on, rather than with that assumption that as soon as we make a decision, our agency goes out the window. Now, that second underlying fear is totally different, right? This one is not about agency, it's about loss. And so that's where a very different skill becomes relevant, which is learning to grieve and make peace with the paths that we didn't choose. And this is something that I think only lived experience can really teach us, right? Because if we believe that grief is not survivable or we'll never be able to move through it, the only way to get our bodies to really believe something different is to go through that process of making a hard choice, staying present and associated to and online with the pain that that hard choice brings up in us, and then watching ourselves survive it and logging the good that comes on the other side of it. So it sounds kind of funny to say, but some of the experiences I am most grateful for in my life are the experiences where grief has been forced upon me. So once through the death of someone who was close to me, and once through a breakup that I felt I essentially had no autonomy or control over, but didn't want to happen. In both cases, I just had to grieve. There was nothing else I could do. There was no levers I could pull. There was no way that I could argue against what was happening. There was no way I could pathologize or try to self-improve my way out of it. I just had to accept that I was losing something I did not want to lose, and I was going to have to find a way to cope with that. But the really cool thing is that when we do go through that process, what we also necessarily notice is the fact that life reorganizes on the other side, right? We don't just stay stuck in that pit of grief forever. We learn tools for moving through it, and we build new lives on the other side of it, which in a lot of cases are actually able to be a lot more cohered and a lot more intentional because we're no longer spending all of this energy keeping options open in the back of our minds. Decision-making across the board becomes easier when we accept that every decision involves grief and that grief is absolutely something we can survive. Fourth strategy you might have internalized when it comes to decision-making as someone with early emotional neglect is to take joy out of the equation and choose from as logical a place as possible. So to optimize for the easiest path or the most profitable path or the path that our families or society would most approve of, and completely ignore either happiness or a lack of happiness as a meaningful signal altogether. And this one can be so hard because for some of us, it can be ingrained to the point of truly seeming invisible. So we may have grown up thinking of positive emotions as sort of frivolous or in some cases even delusional, right? Like we might think, okay, well, nobody's happy all the time. So it's best to just make decisions from a logical place and then get on with them regardless of how they feel. in the process of getting on with them. And then something I've noticed is that for a lot of us, even if we do get to the point in our lives where we start realizing, okay, maybe it's time to start taking more of my emotional experiences seriously, a lot of us with that early neglect patterning will still move immediately to taking the more stereotypically negative feelings seriously and neglecting our more positive ones. So we'll go, okay, maybe there's something useful about anger or about sadness, while totally failing to notice that we've also spent our entire lives tuning out from joy. So for myself, there's one point in my adult life where I realized that if I looked back at all of the committed romantic relationships I'd been in over the course of my adult life, spanning anywhere between 1 to 8 years, I'd only felt really consistently happy in maybe one of them. And to be clear, that wasn't because there is something wrong with all of those other people. And it also wasn't because in that one relationship, I was super elated and over the moon or stuck in the honeymoon phase for the entire time. It just meant that I'd only really had one relationship that felt compatible, and where more often than not, spending time around my partner had felt positive and easeful and enjoyable rather than perpetually challenging. But it had not ever, not even one time, occurred to me to clock that as a problem, because I hadn't learned to think of happiness or unhappiness in a relationship as a useful bar for measuring whether I should be in it. Right? I looked at things like, does it make sense for me to be with this person? Are our aspirations aligned? Are the needs that they have ones that I feel competent at fulfilling? But not ever do I feel happy and alive around them. That just wasn't even on my radar. And so the goal here is not to become completely hedonistic and start chasing happiness at any cost. Okay, the goal is to start treating happiness, just like the rest of our emotions, as a messenger that can alert us to something important. Generally, feeling happy means that we are on the right track in some way. So we've either found a good intersection between our skills and our environment, or we've happened into a very compatible relationship or situation, or that we're growing in a way that feels meaningful, or that the context that we're in is easy on our nervous systems and good for our overall health. So valuing happiness is not about giving in to some delusional fantasy of things feeling wonderful forever, right? It's just about learning to see joy as a signpost that can point us into the direction of where our inner world and our outer context are most naturally aligned. And so we can get the most reward out of our environments for the least inner resistance, which I think is a pretty darn useful thing to pay attention to. And then the fifth and final decision-making strategy we're going to talk about today that you may have internalized if you grew up with early emotional neglect is trying to future-proof yourself against changing desires. Which means we wait to settle on the relationship or the job or the situation that we feel fairly sure we will be the most happy with forever of all possible choices. So the partner who we think we'll probably never be able to do better than, or the city that we think we'll probably never want to move away from, or the career path that we'll probably not have any regrets about choosing down the line, rather than seeing changing desires as a very, very normal part of life that we will necessarily encounter regardless of what decision we end up making. So there is a Kierkegaard quote that I love that goes, "Marry and you will regret it. Don't marry, you will also regret it. Marry or don't marry, you will regret it either way. Laugh at the world's foolishness, you will regret it. Weep over it, you will regret that too. Laugh at the world's foolishness or weep over it, you will regret both." And then he keeps going on giving more examples, but the idea here, or at least the meaning that I like to make out of this quote, is that every decision we make in life, every single one, comes with some downside. So some part of it that we will genuinely regret. And that doesn't mean that all investments are equal in terms of returns, but it does mean that if we go about our lives assuming that the right decision is a decision that comes with no regrets and no second guessing of ourselves, we will probably never in our lives feel like we have made a single right decision. Whereas if we want to get more realistic about our decisions, it can very often help us to keep in mind that sometimes our desires change not because we've made the wrong decision, but because we have made the right one. And we have satisfied some need that now frees us up to build in a new direction. Okay, so changing desires are often a feature of good decisions, not a bug. So maybe we find a partner who feels really stable and solid, and the life that we built with them starts to feel really secure, which ironically allows us to turn our attention outwards towards exploration or a desire for excitement that we didn't have a lot of before. And then maybe we start finding someone else in our lives really attractive who might be more impulsive or more naturally adventurous than our partner is. And one way to make sense out of that attraction would be to go, okay, well, I chose wrong. But another way to make sense out of that would be, I chose so profoundly right that the choice I made is transforming me into someone who now has new needs and curiosities and desires online. And there may very well be a way that we can work with the relationship we have chosen to explore more of that side of ourselves through it. But that brings us all the way back to that first point, right? Where instead of seeing our happiness as located inside of some external circumstance, so another person or a job or the perfect circumstance, we can start to look at how to interact meaningfully with any choice we do make, even after we have made it, to include more and more of what we need as we go. So we take as a given that our desires are going to change as we go through life. And then we develop the skills that we need to adapt our choices en route so that we can accommodate those changing needs as we go. And this is, in my opinion, the skill that ends up taking the most fear and paralysis out of decision-making as a whole. So that skill of staying online to our desires after a decision has been made and figuring out how to make that decision keep fitting us rather than assuming that we must perpetually fit ourselves to it. When we do this, our decisions become more and more right for us over time because they have taken on more and more of our shape. Right? Kind of like shoes that we wear in. They fit us better the more time we spend walking in them in the gait that comes naturally to us. The same is true of the decisions that we keep ourselves online inside of. We choose the stable partner or the stable career path, and then over time, the desire for more excitement arises. And so we find a way to spice up our relationship or our work life. Or we choose the more exciting partner or the more exciting career path. And then when the initial thrill wears off, we find a way to build more stability for ourselves. Any choice that we make ultimately comes with trade-offs. And accepting that from the get-go, that those trade-offs will arise and they won't necessarily be a sign that we chose wrong, can take a ton of pressure off that initial process of making a decision. We're expecting trade-offs and we're eating them for lunch. And I think that that's really the common thread that kind of runs through all of these strategies. When we grow up with early emotional neglect, we can develop this kind of distorted idea of our relationship between self and the environment that leads us to believe that happiness lies inside of the perfect decision. So we spend years trying to find the perfect partner, the perfect city, the perfect career, the perfect path, because we think that's what our happiness depends on. But in reality, the quality of our lives depends way, way less on making the perfect decision and way more on our capacity to stay in relationship with ourselves after a decision has been made. So to keep listening to our emotions and what they're telling us as we go, to keep noticing what's changing or what feels different over time, to keep grieving and letting go of what no longer fits us, or to keep advocating for ourselves and what we need to feel healthy and whole, right? So to keep bringing more and more and more of ourselves as we are now into the lives that we have chosen in the past. Because at the end of the day, a good decision is just any decision that we keep growing and evolving alongside as we go through life. And the better we get at doing that, the less decisions are going to feel like irreversible verdicts about how the rest of our lives will go. And the more they start to feel like the beginning of a conversation between ourselves and our circumstances. All right, that's all I'm going to say on this topic for today. But as always, any thoughts, any questions that have come up for you as you've gone through this video, please leave in the comment section below. I love you guys. I hope you're taking care of yourselves and each other. And I will see you back here again really soon.